is Taking Aim with
Groucho Men
and Maya Schoen, coming to you Tuesday, April 20th, 2004. Every day, some days it seems nearly every hour, a terrorist alarm is sounded somewhere in the world. Each new threat has immediate consequences, writes Don Van Natta, Jr. in the New York Times, Sunday, April 18th, 2004. A world made more dangerous as terrorism spreads. He continues, flights may be canceled, a few embassies closed, and it almost always stokes fear that another terrorist attack is imminent. In a lost world of what-ifs, could anything have stopped 9/11, writes Eric Lichtblau, also in the New York Times on April 18th. And in speaking to law enforcement officials, Lichtblau states, even if they had known about Al-Qaeda's intentions, there was little they could have done to prevent 9/11. He says, they say that short of declaring martial law, yes, short of declaring martial law, the administration could not have risked public outrage by targeting Muslim men at airports, and they faced a murky threat with no specific site and time frame. Over the last few weeks, and again next week, we've been hearing from the U.S. authorities and the response of the 9/11 Commission members. Today, on Taking Aim, the 9/11 Commission hearings and the architecture of the police state. And that is what they are aiming at. The architecture, increasing the architecture of the police state, terrorism everywhere, nothing short of martial law can stop it. And what is necessary, according to John Ashcroft? Bring down the wall that separates the intelligence agencies, increase funding, and, according to all the CIA spokespeople, allow the CIA unlimited authority to take down enemies here, there, and everywhere. Ralph?
The theme that has been orchestrated in the 9/11 Commission hearings is that the funding for the Central Intelligence Agency and for counterterrorism activity and for the intelligence apparatus of the 13 intelligence agencies was virtually gone. That they were dismantling the counterintelligence operations, that they were starved of funds, that Osama bin Laden was recruiting at a rate five times greater than the combined recruitment of the FBI and the Central Intelligence Agency. One of the most compelling of these claims, and it was orchestrated by virtually everybody who was called before them, from Condoleezza Rice to James Pavitt of the Central Intelligence Agency to George Tenet of the Central Intelligence Agency to Robert Mueller and Louis Freeh of the Federal Bureau of Investigation to Kofor Black, who was the director of the CIA's Counterterrorist Center, as he stated, from 1999 until May of 2002, but who didn't inform the commission that he had been in charge of counter-terrorist operations throughout Latin America and in Africa for many years before that. What did emerge in part was his role in the Sudan in 1995. But what wasn't disclosed is that Kofor Black was the counter-terrorist and CIA point man in supporting the South African apartheid regime in funding and organizing the UNITA of Savimbi that led to 2 million deaths in Angola, in defending the apartheid, the white settler regimes of southern and northern Rhodesia, in using the Central Intelligence Agency counter-terrorist apparatus, even then, in attempting to destroy the United National Independence Party of Kenneth Kaunda in Zambia, and the struggles of Joshua Nkoma and Robert Mugabe in what would become Zimbabwe. So indeed we see here Kofor Black, the director of the CIA's counter-terrorist center, as a point man in targeting every movement that sought self-determination for oppressed people, labeling it even then as a terrorist apparatus. And indeed, he says, before 9/11, and I'm quoting from his testimony, the CIA's counterterrorism center had as many people as three infantry companies. But three infantry companies can be expected to cover a front of only a few kilometers, and our counterterrorism center has worldwide responsibilities for terrorist threats in every part of the world. Not only Al-Qaeda must we engage. Hezbollah killed more Americans than any other terrorist group. Hezbollah is our responsibility among all the others. We work through the directorate of operations deployed everywhere overseas. But the head of the operations directorate will tell you we had 25% less covert direction, operations officers at the end of the 1990s than we had at the start. The director of Central Intelligence did all he could. We had the highest priority. Prior to my arrival, the director had increased our personnel, but we didn't have the funds. The DCI and the deputy director of operations struggled with huge shortages. While all the other operating components were being cut, counterterrorism received minimal increases, cash. This is what we use to pay for operations. At the beginning of each of my three fiscal years as chief, the counterterrorism center didn't have enough money for two modern jet fighter aircraft. We faced a fiscal reality. We had less money with which to support our operations than we had in years before. I cut all my subordinate units, except one, at least 30%. We survived because of relentless support with supplemental funding to make do, to make do. Now, this theme of a supposed devastated intelligence apparatus and Department of Defense apparatus, which was sounded by Tenet and sounded by Mueller and sounded by Pavitt and sounded by Kofor Black in particular, is an extraordinary example of the big lie orchestrated and imposed. Here we have the testimony and the statement of Robert J. Lieberman, Deputy Inspector General, Department of Defense, before the Subcommittee on Government Efficiency, Financial Management, and Intergovernmental Relations, in which he states, Department-level accounting adjustment entries have found that $4.4 trillion have been unaccounted for, with $1.1 trillion without any explanatory information and audit details in 1 year. Indeed, in 1999, $7.6 trillion were without accounting, $2.3 trillion wholly unsupported. This is the government's accounting report on the looting of trillions of dollars, $7.6 trillion, and they're talking about not having enough money to go to the John. This is nothing but a propaganda exercise, these 9/11 commission hearings, bought into by all of the commissioners, rolling their eyes and commiserating with the testifiers about how this has to be corrected and how it's now necessary to break down the wall of separation between these clandestine operations and the operation of the justice system within the United States itself.
Ralph, it is accepted and orchestrated by the staff of the commission itself. In fact, prior to Tenet's testimony on March 24th, during the public testimony portion before the 9/11 panel, there was a report by Deputy Executive Director Chris Kohm, that's K-O-J-M, that he's the Deputy Executive Director for the 9/11 panel, working under the Executive Director, Dr. Philip Zelikow. And he talks about the development of the Predator drone and how it was used in Afghanistan, and the fact that the CIA had wanted to use armed Predators, just as they did in Yemen later once it was developed. But what they encountered with the Air Force was that the Air Force said it didn't have the funding. It would have taken years to create this drone. And that, quote, they were throwing out the books on the normal acquisition process just to press on and get it done, end of quote. And he then goes on to say that the Deputy National Security Advisor, Stephen Hadley, ordered that the armed predator to be ready by September 1st of 2001. They're talking about the events leading up to 9/11. But that policymakers were arguing about the unprecedented step of creating a missile system for use by an agency outside of the Department of Defense. So here we have the commission staff itself talking about the fact that there's a wall between agencies, that they have to go through a bureaucratic process to get the funding necessary to create their weapons of mass destruction, and supporting, in fact, leading up to, setting the stage for Tenet and Pavitt and all the others. And again, we have over and over again Comb talking about the protecting the American interests overseas. He continues, the Counterterrorism Center identified 30 possible overseas targets and launched disruption operations around the world. They are saying that prior to 9/11, the CIA was hampered because it had only two means of dealing with so-called terrorists. One was disrupting their activity and particularly using what they surrogate forces, such as in Afghanistan, the Pashtuns or the Northern Alliance, and the other was renditions, capturing and then bringing the so-called terrorists to a third country. In other words, not bringing them back to the United States, but bringing them to countries, as we've discussed in shows such as Without Restraint some time ago, where they felt free to torture at will. Ralph?
Let us be clear about this. At the same time that they're pleading poverty and seeking to use these hearings as a propaganda platform with which to orchestrate the necessity for unlimited funding and the absence of any restraints upon their activity, Ashcroft initiated his testimony with an all-out attack on the Clinton administration and targeting one of the commissioners, Jamie Gorelick, who had responsibilities as an attorney general aide and as a person in charge of intelligence as well, for presumptive opposition to allowing the secret intelligence services to operate domestically in criminal prosecutions in the United States. Gorelick responded with the revelation of a 1995 memorandum that Sheetwood had put forward, which called for the removal of any so-called wall between these operations. Well, what are we really describing here? The architecture of the police state. The wall they want to tear down is known as due process. It means the right to confront an accuser. It means the presumption of innocence as opposed to assumptions of guilt. It means the right to know what you are charged with, the right to confront your accuser, the right to have a defense, the right to air publicly what the charges are and to challenge them in a court of law. That's the wall. That's the differential between formal protections and a police state. That's the difference between civil liberties, due process, constitutional rights, and martial law. This wall that they're talking about and the rapid capitulation of the Benvenistes and the Gorelicks and the Romers and the Democrats involved on this commission is a signing on for the martial law state, which these hearings were designed to prepare.
Ralph, let's go back again to the report prepared by the commission staff. This is the so-called neutral report that is presented to the commission members prior to having the directors, such as Tenet, speak for themselves. And Comb continues, quote, many CIA officers, including Deputy Director for Operations Pavitt, have criticized policymakers for not giving the CIA authorities meaning enough power, to conduct effective operations against bin Laden. This issue manifests itself in a debate about the scope of covert actions in Afghanistan authorized by President Clinton, NSC staff, and CIA officials. And again, he goes on to talk about it. Some legal advisors in the Clinton administration agreed that under the law of armed conflict, killing a person who posed an imminent threat to the United States was an act of self-defense, not an assassination, end quote. So here we have the commission itself stating that Clinton and the attorneys, the lawyers that Ashcroft railed against, are stating that killing a person is acceptable. And what does it mean when you say killing a person who poses an imminent threat? Who is to define if a person is an imminent threat? And that this is not assassination. They are redefining what assassination is as you and I know it.
Why, one of the themes, too, that has been presented in these commission hearings, and unchallenged it was that the Al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden terror apparatus is global in 68 countries, indeed in 100 countries, overwhelmingly powerful, unstoppable, responsible, as Condoleezza Rice stated, for every terror act that has occurred. And she cited, for example, the Achille Lauro. The Achille Lauro.
She cited it as an attack against America. She has to relook at her history.
Well, it's not just a question of an attack against America, but as an Al-Qaeda operation, mm-hmm. when the Achille Lauro had been imputed to the Palestine Liberation Organization until Viktor Ostrovsky, the colonel in the Mossad who wrote the book By Way of Deception and the Other Side of Deception, established that, in fact, the Achille Lauro was an operation of Rafi Eitan of the Israeli Mossad, in which, through a Sicilian don, funding was provided, and indeed Abul Abbas of the Palestine Liberation Organization was enlisted for what was assumed to be the occupation of the pleasure ship for a declaration of the needs of the Palestinian people without any further action. But in fact, the covert operations of the Mossad took over, and the Mossad operatives threw overboard Leon Klinghoffer, the elderly Jewish man who was confined to a wheelchair and brutally thrown overboard. All of this imputed to the PLO. Ostrovsky has documented that this was a Mossad operation from beginning to end. The fingerprint of the Mossad clear. Rafi Eitan in charge of the affair. Ostrovsky documenting this. And then Ostrovsky gave evidence that the Mossad was involved in a series of other events. The World Trade Center bombing in 1993. And indeed, Ostrovsky indicates that the Israelis were involved in the attack on the USS Cole. Indeed, on October 19th, the BBC News Online reported that the explosive taken from the destroyer were identified by U.S. investigators as a type available only in Israel and the United States. And it's instructive that that C4 explosive, which was the fingerprint of the attack on the USS Cole, a billion-dollar ship attacked by supposedly a $5,000 gunboat, the same C4 shows up in the bombing of the embassy in Nairobi in 1998. And as the San Francisco Chronicle has reported, the point man in that was a high-level FBI operative, not only involved in the bombing of the U.S. Embassy in Nairobi, but assigned the task of providing bodyguards for none other than Osama bin Laden, high-level FBI operative, the characteristic false flag operation. And every one of these intelligence-sponsored events cited in these hearings as the work of a global network of terror, which must be responded to with permanent war, as Kofor Black described it, for at least 30 to 40 years. The full mobilizing of the vast apparatus of a $10 trillion state, American capitalism, in global war, in martial law at home.
Ralph, throughout the hearings, people like Tenet, CIA Director Tenet, have been pointing to the wall. Ashcroft makes a lot about the wall between the intelligence agencies and the importance to break down the walls that impede cooperation. And in Time magazine this week, they talk about four dots American intelligence failed to connect. And they point to January 7th, 1995, Operation Bojinka in Manila, Philippines, and to Malaysia, January 5th, 2000, where there was a meeting that included Khalid al-Migdar and Nawaf al-Hazmi. And then the third, July 10th, 2001, the Phoenix Memorandum of FBI agent Kenneth Williams. And August 13, 2001, a report of Zacharias Massawi and the fact that he had asked to train on 747s. And they say that these were four dots that could have been connected had there not been a wall, and the FBI and the CIA had worked on their clues and had communicated better. But most of all, when they talk about walls, they say that these were brought down by the Patriot Act, the USA Patriot Act, which stands for Uniting and Strengthening America by providing appropriate tools required to intercept and obstruct terrorism, Act of 2001, which was passed overwhelmingly for 45 days after the events of 9/11, and really is the first stage of setting up the architecture of the police state, because, as been reported, in the Department of Justice, there were secret plans that had been released later for the Domestic Security Enhancement Act, or Patriot II, which would extend police powers. And I think we should take a moment to discuss these, because this is very much what they're talking about when they're saying breaking down the walls between the FBI and the CIA. And very much in the press recently, we have discussions, and President Bush supported setting up a domestic intelligence operation similar to Britain's MI5. And what they are intending to do with Patriot Act II, which became public in February of 2003, was to expand law enforcement and intelligence gathering authority, basically in unprecedented ways, to reduce and eliminate judicial oversight over government surveillance, because that's what they're saying is really impeding the work of the FBI and the CIA. Over and again, they point to the fact that there are too many lawyers and everyone is worried about whether or not this is acceptable, what they're doing is acceptable. They want to be able to authorize more secret arrests and detentions without the public knowing about it, much in the way they arrested and detained immigrants after 9/11 without releasing their names, create a secret DNA database of people who are suspected of association with any group that the government in its vague way has designated as terrorist, create new death penalty provisions, and empower the government to strip citizenships from Americans who belong or support to groups that are considered in disfavor. In other words, groups that are in any way providing any sort of what's considered material support to what the government, groups the government considers terrorists. And as you recall, this was the case in South Africa or in El Salvador or Nicaragua. And then there would be a new category that was created in Patriot 1, and that's the category of domestic terrorism. Now, the legal definition of domestic terrorism is now so broad that the San Francisco Labor Council had a committee formed to investigate and study the Patriot Act 2, and they stated categorically that the new definition of domestic terrorism, quote, encompasses traditional forms of job actions and concerted activities by unions, such as nonviolent picket lines, civil disobedience, or strikes. Ralph?
The call for virtual martial law, and again the theme of the hearings was the necessity to intensify the role of coordinated intelligence operations and to break down, as you have described it, Maya, the wall, to give a free hand to these Black Operations, CIA, DIA, counter-terrorist apparatus spying on U.S. citizens, and to define material support for terrorists as any contact with a person suspected or accused of something called terrorism. Once again, every time that these themes of repression and the need to massively fund the intelligence apparatus and to take any restraints off its operations was invoked during these hearings, simultaneously they would bring up a putative attack by the terrorist apparatus that is so vast and powerful, the ultimate conspiracy theory, more menacing than the Soviet Union, more dangerous than international communism, more powerful than 50,000 hydrogen bomb weapons and missiles, is Osama bin Laden and the Al-Qaeda apparatus. Again, the coal, the World Trade Center bombing in 1993, the constant leitmotif to justify these repressive measures. Let's just take one moment, Maya, to look at the justifications and what they amount to. U.S. officials, and I'm quoting here from the Washington Post on December 9, 2000, U.S. officials acknowledge that there is no evidence that bin Laden was behind the coal attack. Thomas Ricks and Vernon Loeb, President Ali Abdullah Saleh, stated over and over again, Israel is responsible for the bombing of the USS Cole. Yemen's president named names. This is the Washington Post on December 10th, 2000, pointing to the specific explosives as an explosive in the arsenal of Israel supplied by the United States. Again, the false flag operation invoked continuously, not only to justify the unlimited funding of the national security state, but to provide the basis for martial law and for total repression within the United States itself.
Ralph, they're depending on short-term memory lapse, and not even long-term memory lapse, but short-term memory lapse, as Condoleezza Rice in particular rewrites history, and the others appearing before the commission, and the commission itself is doing the same. But most of all, they do depend on the agents of the bourgeois press. The Sunday New York Times is replete with article after article reinventing history, orchestrating the need for virtual martial law. And again, I have to cite another article from the Sunday's New York Times by James Risen, How to Improve Domestic Intelligence. And he states from Washington, quote, before September 11th, Al-Qaeda terrorists took advantage of yawning gaps between the Central Intelligence Agency and the Federal Bureau of Investigation in order to slip into the United States. Look at the terminology he's using here. Assumptions on Al-Qaeda terrorists, as if it's a known fact that Al-Qaeda is responsible for September 11th. There is no proof of that. And again, accepting the so-called wall and the divisions between the CIA and the FBI, when he uses the term yawning gaps, and again slipping into the United States as if they were undercover, and when in fact they moved freely as people for whom there was no suspicion and could move at will. So he then goes on to say that the commission hearing, they recounted in, quote, painful detail the lapses of the CIA and the FBI, and then considered ways of reforming the way the government collects intelligence. Again and again, this is a total orchestration, and the orchestration is done within the prestigious New York Times. So we have here the New York Times itself supporting the creation of domestic intelligence agencies such as MI5. Basically, what do we have? If not just the New York Times, we've pointed to also Time Magazine, Newsweek, and on and on. You are listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman.
And Maya Schoen over WBAI, which is 99.5 FM on your dial in the tri-state area of New York, and on the internet at www.wbai.org. Today we are discussing the 9/11 Commission and the architecture of the police state.
Bob Kerry, the former Democratic senator from Nebraska, again set the tone. He said we were going to have to expand our war on terror for the next 30 to 40 years. And he went again, I have to repeat, back to the question of the coal. Quote, the coal goes to the heart of the problem in dealing with the unconventional war outside and inside the United States. Given the link of the coal to the embassy attacks, Bob Kerry says, why didn't we do more than cruise missiles or a Normandy invasion? Why have we waited so long? Why are we not doing something in the United States about the thousands of terrorists poised to strike within the U.S.? This is Kerry and addressing Tenet and Picard and Cavett and Mueller. And at this point, Benveniste, the former federal prosecutor long associated with FBI sting operations, takes up the theme, but he lets out something that wasn't supposed to be heard in these hearings. He said, well, we had intelligence that showed that Al-Qaeda was penetrated and that there were rogue elements inside Al-Qaeda responsible for the coal without the knowledge of Osama bin Laden. Pregnant silence in the hearing room. Suddenly comes the response from Pavitt. I will never forget the spectacle of Osama bin Laden chortling and laughing as he congratulated those before him for the events of 9/11 and stated that the terrorists on board the aircraft were not even aware that the people in the cockpit were intending a suicide operation. Now, they're referring to the videotape that had been released with the Central Intelligence Agency providing the transcript because the audio was not distinguishable. The words could not be made out. But later exposed by Hani Sibai in London as a complete scissor and paste job in which they took a videotape of 18 months before of Osama bin Laden at a wedding ceremony praising the and congratulating the participants in the wedding ceremony and married it into this tape, imputing the remarks that were transliterated by the CIA of Osama bin Laden as having to do with 9/11, the BBC and Al Jazeera and across the Arab world exposing this utter fabrication. And that is what was constantly in evidence at these 9/11 hearings, the big lie. United orchestration of the false flag operations of the United States and Israeli authorities themselves, imputing to a fictive worldwide apparatus that is nothing so much as a creation of the intelligence agencies themselves.
Ralph, again, going back to the article by Eric Lichtbaum in this Sunday's New York Times, he writes, quote, he quotes an aviation security specialist, Charles Slepian, quote, we had ample evidence that Al-Qaeda wanted to attack America, but we just stood by and waited for something to happen. Charles Slepian, a specialist on aviation security who now heads a group called Foreseeable Risk Analysis Center, again quoting, it was just another Tuesday in September and it should not have been that way. By spring and early summer of 2001, Lichtbaum writes, American intelligence officials were beginning to see worrisome and increasingly dire signs of terrorist activities. Intelligence reports disclosed last week by the September 11th Commission warned that bin Laden threats are real. That was the title of one of the reports. And bin Laden planning high-profile attacks was another. George J. Tenet, the CIA director, received a briefing paper that August titled, Islamic Extremist Learns to Fly, about the arrests earlier in Minnesota of Zacharias Moussaoui. And an intelligence briefing that President Bush got at his ranch at Crawford, Texas, headlined, Bin Laden determined to strike in United States, discussed the possibility of Al-Qaeda operatives hijacking planes. Now, again and again, and this refers again to the Time magazine, Four Dots, American Intelligence Failed to Connect, they're blaming it on the inadequate connections and also the inadequate discussion among intelligence agencies to prevent these attacks. When in fact, as we have been showing over and again, the real question is who within the United States security apparatus was organizing these attacks, was promoting these attacks, was initiating these attacks.
Let's look at that very carefully, Maya, because one of the mantras of the 9/11 Commission hearings, every testimony that was heard before it responded to with mewling and sycophantic support from the members of the commission concerned the attack on the World Trade Center in 1993, the attack which was imputed to Al-Qaeda, and indeed imputed to the blind Egyptian cleric Sheikh Rahman, whose mosques were in Brooklyn and in New Jersey. Now, Lynn Stewart, the heroic figure who has been the lawyer for Sheikh Rahman, and mounted a defense based on evidence. The evidence that's been now established in such media as the Village Voice, the New York Times, and the Los Angeles Times, of the hand of the FBI and of the Mossad all over the events of 1993. Not only the bombing of the World Trade Center in 1993, which was a dry run all right for 9/11, as the authorities constantly tell us, but it's their dry run. Because here's what's at issue. Ahmad Ali Salem is a high-level FBI operative. We've discussed it frequently on Taking Aim. A person who was ranking in Egyptian intelligence and working for the largest field station of the Federal Bureau of Investigation in the United States, the New York office. He went into the mosque of the blind Egyptian cleric, and he recruited young men on a need-to-know basis for the following project, for bombing the World Trade Center. 1993. He provided the explosives supplied by the Federal Bureau of Investigation. He went into his meeting wearing a wire. He recorded every conversation and he made transcripts, and the transcripts were put into the Federal Bureau of Investigation offices in New York. They filled 50 file boxes for a period of 6 months. Ahmad Ali Salem, the FBI operative, was in coordination with a Mossad operative named Guzi Hadass. She was the one who coordinated the safe house and the Ryder rental van. Here is Time magazine and the Daily Telegraph in London, June 23, 2003. The American Al-Qaeda operative unmasked last week as having planned to bring down the Brooklyn Bridge was disclosed to have been an FBI agent. It was reported yesterday. The authorities did not acknowledge that Farris, who had been ordered to study ultralight aircraft and to derail trains in chemical storage facilities in Washington, had been under complete FBI control for months. This is the story of David Rennie in Washington for the Daily Telegraph. Repeated in Time magazine. Installed in a safe house in Virginia, Farris sent messages to terrorists by mobile phone and email. Sitting in a safe house, making calls for us, acknowledged the senior Bush administration to Time magazine. This is what we're dealing with. The intelligence apparatus of the United States, the rulers of the United States, terrorizing the American people. It is their apparatus. These are their operations. This is their mechanism for creating a permanent war, for funding a permanent war across the planet, and for providing the architecture of the police state in the United States under the rationale of a war against terror. The landmark case, no less significant than the bombing of the World Trade Center in 1993, equally the work of Imad Ali Salem and the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and of such high-level operatives as Zayman Faris, who was just described in the Daily Telegraph and Time magazine. Blowing up what? The Statue of Liberty, the George Washington Bridge, the Lincoln Tunnel, the Holland Tunnel, the United Nations. All of this, again, cited ad nauseam in these 9/11 hearings by Tenet, by Pavitt, by Mueller. With Romer and Gorelick and Kane and John Lehman, the Secretary of the Navy under Reagan, picking up on the theme and talking about the necessity now for taking away any restraint upon the intelligence apparatus of the United States, either in terms of funding or of arbitrary rule.
Ralph, everyone is more patriotic than thou, and that is what they continue the drum roll and the trumpets. You also have to remember that after 9/11, the United States policy became to build ever more military bases throughout the world and to deploy troops even more so around the world. As an article Sunday, March 21st, 2004, in the San Francisco Chronicle by James Sterngold noted, after 9/11, the U.S. policy built on world bases. And there is an arc of new facilities in places like Uzbekistan, Pakistan, Qatar, and Djibouti, which the Pentagon calls lily pads, and they're jumping off points for, quote, preventive wars, preventing future wars. And this is in keeping with the national security strategy that Bush put out in September of 2002. Quote, there's clearly been a militarization of foreign policy initially justified on the basis of the events of 9/11, said Charlene Barshefsky, the United States trade representative under President Bill Clinton. And her point is that the military portion of policy has defined our entire policy. In fact, the military portion of policy has been the prime aspect of the United States budget under the Democratic Party as well as the Republican Party, and incorporates more than 50% of the discretionary budget, and even more if you count all the additional appropriations for the Balkans, for the Afghanistan war, and for the war against Iraq. The United States has over 6,000 military bases in the United States. And every senator and every representative endorses that because they create employment in their home area. And they also endorse the expansion of the military-industrial base, military-industrial complex on the same basis. And there are 702 bases in 130 countries around the world. 130 countries. As I said, from Uzbekistan to Kyrgyzstan to Tajikistan to, you know, as well as throughout Europe and Asia. And they're moving now, the soldiers, the 75,000 soldiers who still are in Germany, and there are 47,000 in Japan, and where the United States maintains 73 bases in Japan, the islands of Japan, 37,000 in Korea, 13,000 in Italy, 12,000 in England. And there's still the major air and submarine bases in Guam and Diego Garcia. So we have throughout the world, as I mentioned, 130 countries. We have U.S. troops stationed, and we also have smaller stations for the so-called lily pads. So all this is for the great military might. But in the United States, as we've been talking about throughout the program, there is the focus in the last days about the architecture of the police state here and the domestic intelligence operations. As noted by Vanity Fair in the February 2004 issue, an article on the feature about John Ashcroft, Patriot Games is the title, they note that there have been 113 emergency authorizations for secret warrants issued by FISA in the first year alone after the passing of the USA Patriot Act. That's more than twice the number that were granted in the previous 23 years. The most extensive investigation in the history of the United States, as the Justice Department noted. Ralph?
One of the themes that was developed throughout these hearings was how Robert Mueller, the head of the FBI, and Louis Freeh, and George Tenet of the Central Intelligence Agency, and James Pavitt, and Kofor Black, and General Hughes of the Defense Intelligence Agency were no longer to be separated, but were to work in close conjunction with each other in developing the war on terror at home and abroad. Who is Robert Mueller, about whom the commissioners were so sycophantic, none more so than Richard Benvenisti? The real character of Robert Mueller is extremely instructive. Mueller was selected as the new director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and he had a very particular history. He was responsible for covering up the relationship of BCCI to Bush Sr. Indeed, Robert Mueller, who replaced Louis Freeh as the FBI director, was the third in command in the FBI under George Terwilliger, and he was involved in keeping the Iran-Contra scheme under wraps and for helping the Department of Justice Domestic Criminal Section Chief David Margolis and International Criminal Section Mark Richards suppress all evidence of the role of Reagan and Bush Sr. in these events. Mueller handled personally containing the charges about Bush Sr. in his dealings with the coffee merchant Mansour Barbouti and the laundering of funds and the illegal exportation of chemicals for use in chemical weapons in Iraq and in Iran. Mueller had worked as a master cover-up for Bush and Sr. in all of these schemings and intrigues. In fact, as was documented by Al Martin, the former admiral, in his book, The Conspirators, Mueller was the point man with Oliver North in suppressing the evidence about the protection of the CIA of the Bush-Reagan people with the BCCI scandal of money laundering, covert operations, and drug smuggling. These are a gangster clique in charge of the United States. This is the apparatus that is designing martial law for our people, a group of corrupt, unaccountable, conspiratorial terror masters of a state apparatus that is terrorizing the American people.
Ralph, since 9/11, there have been more than 18,000 so-called anti-terrorism subpoenas and search warrants issued. 18,000. The most disconcerting is the fact that the an attorney-client conversation, the conversation between a detainee and their lawyer is subject to tapping, is subject to being heard by the government. And what's noted in this Vanity Fair article is that the government has long been able to pierce the attorney-client privilege by listening in on such conversations when the attorney himself may be considered to be facilitating a crime. We did it under Clinton, says former Deputy Attorney General Eric Holder, but we went to a judge to do it. So for those of you who are still under the illusion that the Democratic Party has more of an interest in civil liberties, please listen closely to what the former Deputy Attorney General Eric Holder stated. We did it under Clinton. Because when he says we went to a judge, you have to realize that in an examination of what was done with the FISA judges and with most judges is that they always cater to what is asked of them by the Department of Justice. Under Ashcroft 2 years ago, this need for judicial approval was erased, providing both attorney and client were informed. In other words, this is something they'll forget, that we are listening in to everything you are saying. We are listening in to everything you are saying. So this is called sneak and peek. Also, sneak and peek is where you gain access to the content of homes, offices, and as people have made much about, the library selections without informing a suspect. And this is now done within the context of the Patriot Act. But all this is still not enough. And that's why with Patriot 2, even though Patriot 2 as an entirety was stopped, aspects of it are being incorporated within much of the legislation that is going before Congress. Ralph.
There is a culmination to all this, Maya. The Atlantic Monthly for March, a very significant article called The Armageddon Plan by James Mann. Quote, during the Reagan era, Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld were key players in a clandestine program designed to set aside the legal lines of succession and immediately install a new president in the event of a disastrous attack. The program explains the behavior of the Bush administration on and after 9/11. At least once a year during the 1980s, Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld vanished. Cheney was working diligently on Capitol Hill as a congressman, rising through the ranks of the Republican leadership. Rumsfeld, who had served as Gerald Ford's Secretary of Defense, was a hard-driving business executive at the head of J.D. Searle Company, in charge of NutraSweet and Equal and Metamucil. But for 3 or 4 days at a time, no one knew where Cheney was, and no one could locate Rumsfeld. Even their wives were in the dark. They were handed only a mysterious Washington phone number to use in case of emergency. After leaving their day jobs, Cheney and Rumsfeld made their way to Andrews Air Force Base outside Washington, where in the middle of the night, joined by a team of 60 national security officials and a member of Reagan's cabinet, they slipped away to a remote location in the United States, a disused military base, an underground bunker, a convoy of lead-lined trucks carrying sophisticated communications equipment and gear to head for each of the locations. The article continues, Rumsfeld and Cheney were the principal actors in the most highly classified program. The U.S. officials furtively carrying on exercises for taking control of the federal government, setting aside legal rules for presidential succession in favor of a secret procedure for putting in place a new president and his staff. The inspiration for this program came from within the administration itself. And then the article, which is elaborate, describes the on-hand yearly continued preparations for secret exercises for taking control of the United States government. This is not some abstract, excuse me, Maya, I'm quoting, this is not an abstract textbook plan, practice in concrete in elaborate detail. Each team was named for a color, and an experienced operation plan was in place.
Ralph, it's called the Continuity of Government Program. And on April 7th, Nightline had a program with Ted Koppel on the Armageddon plan, and included in that was Richard Clark, the former counterterrorism chief who spoke on and on at the 9/11 hearings. And he notes that, quote, every federal agency was ordered on the morning of 9/11 to activate an alternative command post, an alternative headquarters outside of Washington, D.C., and to staff it as soon as possible. And he had participated, along with Cheney and Rumsfeld, in the continuity of government plan, the so-called Armageddon plan, in prior years. And he notes that in these instances, martial law would have been put in place because the Congress wouldn't been operating. And we have here Ted Koppel saying, are you serious? Is this going to be martial law or rights going to be suspended? And Kenneth Duberstein, the former White House chief of staff, states categorically, quote, you have to suspend rights.
What was the point of these chiefs of having guys like you and Don Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney, each of whom had been a chief of staff to the president, on these teams? Duberstein responds to Koppel. The person who runs the staff, the people who put together a new government, the people who are training to be president of the United States, the people who are going to be in control, are rehearsing for the necessity of martial law. Richard Clark, you order United States forces to do something, and they must do it. Yes, that is correct. Edwin Meese, we have an organization in the Pentagon called the Continuity of Government Team.
We're out of time now. We'll be with you again next week. This has been Taking Aim with
Rob Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, 9/11 Commission Hearings and the Architecture of the Police State. I'm sorry to interrupt Ralph midstream. And you can reach us at takingaim@pacbell.net or takingaim@wbai.org or call us at 707-552-9995. We have an internet site, www.takingaim.info. And as I mentioned again, we'll continue next week.